what we call different groups of people, and how it's evolving. It is hard to keep up with the latest terminology when it comes to describing people's identities. Some of the current labels you might hear include Latinx, BIPOC, and LGBTQIA+. But these labels are not embraced by all. They are controversial even within the groups they describe. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss how terms that describe groups are changing, why some of the older terms can be considered obsolete or offensive, and how to talk about others in a real way that is accurate and reflects everyone's value as a human being. Have you ever stumbled when you try to say the right thing? What do you think of some of the terms being used right now? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. In the last year, you may have heard the term BIPOC and been unsure of what it stands for. Many terms come and go as the preferred labels for different groups of people. Today, we'll discuss how these evolve and how they describe people's identities. Joining us to discuss this, Nicolette Mitchell, who is Director of Equity and Education at Bates College, and Theodore Green, an Assistant Professor of Sociology at Bowdoin College. We invite your questions and comments. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. A brief email, please. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Before we talk about the terms of the day, I'd really like to ask each of you to comment on the verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin. And Theo, as a sociologist, what do you see as the broader implications of Chauvin being found guilty in the murder of George Floyd?
In terms of the implications, I think we are still seeing the holes, the structural problems, I think, in terms of policing and race and racism in the United States. As I listened to the verdict yesterday, I could still think about Adam Toledo, who over the weekend at 13 years old was killed by police gunfire. I think for many of us, we can take a deep breath and say it's about time, but we have to also ask, what did it take for a police officer to be convicted for killing a person of color? It took someone 10 minutes on someone's neck. And I think it just reminds us of the broader sort of systemic problems in terms of policing and the deep entrenchment of racism in these structures that's continued to oppress communities of color.
Nicolette, turning to you, we've seen a year of racial activism prompted by George Floyd's death. Do you think that the verdict is significant progress? And what do you think needs to happen next?
Absolutely. I've been thinking a lot. I, like Professor Green, was watching the verdict when it came in yesterday. And I, in one sense, felt a sense of relief that, okay, there's a step towards accountability. There's an acknowledgement of the humanity of Black people in the United States. But is that the end goal? I think for me, I'm thinking no. I'm thinking there's going to be more. I think, you know, Dr. Green hit the nail on the head. There's a system that we need to address. There are multiple holes that need to be filled. And I can't help but think about the case that just happened in Columbus, that there are additional protests and riots happening in our country right now. So I think for a lot of people, they described George Floyd's death as an awakening. But for me, again, it's bittersweet. It's been happening for a really long time. It's been 500 years of of colonialism. Racism in the country of the United States. And so, I think it means that there's going to be more work to do. So
our topic today, the show we set up for today, does relate to what we've been talking about. It was during last summer's Black Lives Matter protest that many people began hearing the term BIPOC used more often. And Theo, first of all, tell us what the acronym stands for and why it became the term of choice instead of some of the words we used to hear often, such as minorities.
Yeah, so to start, BIPOC refers to Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And it was mobilized, I think, it became popularized during the Black Lives Matter movement, and in particular, foregrounding Black and Indigenous nations to think about, again, the long systemic history of oppression from African Americans, Black people, as well as the Indigenous nations, the United States. And at first, I think there was a lot of confusion. You know, the New York Times actually initially thought the B stood for bisexual and people of color. But it began to pick up parlance. It began to sort of become mobilized as again, we saw these protests for Black Lives Matter, you know, not only in the United States and cities across the country, but around the world sort of picked this up. We then began to see it also appear in newspaper articles and now even in diversity statements and institutions. So it sort of picked up pretty quickly, I think, aided by social media, ran like wildfire. And I think now we're beginning to sort of think about some of those tensions with that particular label.
Theo, we just lost you for a second there. Oh, there you are. Okay, go ahead.
I was just mentioning some of the tensions with the label. It seems like increasingly, I always say it's like a naming problem, like the Supremes and then Diana Ross and the Supremes. When you had the Supremes, you had three individual personalities and three different singers. And then all of a sudden, you foreground, when you bring out Diana Ross, you have one singer and you have a group. And I think the same problem sort of exists now that we're now seeing anti-Asian violence. We're seeing violence by other groups. It sort of erases, in a lot of ways, the trajectory of how each of these different marginalized populations has experienced racism in the United States. Nevertheless, I think we're still using it as a way to sort of target white supremacy in the United States and challenging, again, the structures that continue to oppress peoples of color, not only within this country, but in other places around the world.
And Nicolette, let me let you pick up on that idea of tensions with this term. I understand that even within the groups of people this term describes, there are people who don't like it.
Absolutely. So even with the term POC or people of color that foregrounded BIPOC, I know I heard folks critiquing that, saying that, you know, it's erasure by homogenizing such a diverse group of people. I heard people take issue with that. But then even with BIPOC now emerging as a term, folks are feeling erasure because, you know, if we foreground Black and Indigenous issues, are those the only issues that we speak about? And then what if folks don't fall into the categories of BIPOC? You know, who falls into BIPOC? Who gets to use the term? Who gets to define who's a part of that community? There's tons of conversations happening within the groups that fall under the, you know, umbrella of BIPOC, but then also what's happening on campus is that folks who might not see themselves as a part of that umbrella are wondering, okay, is this a term that I use when referring to this group of people? Is this only a term that's used for that particular group? So on campus, we've been thinking a lot about, you know, who gets to apply a label, who gets to define and decide which labels get used and when. When do they become redundant, or when do they become, you know, when should we just refer to specific groups when we're talking about specific groups? If we're talking about issues that are germane to the Black community, then should we just say Black people? And so there's tons and tons of complexities even with the term BIPOC as it emerges and has, you know, I think Dr. Green talked about how it's, you know, become used in some of these diversity statements. So.
Do you believe it's a temporary term, that we're going to come up with something else next? Nicolette?
This is a loaded question.
I didn't mean it to be. I was just wondering.
No, seriously, it's a really, really good question, though, because I even in thinking about the topic of labels today and preparing for this show, I thought about the, you know, how ephemeral past terms have been to describe groups of people. So, you know, minorities might have been a great term that was used in the past, but now folks feel particularly othered when that term is used. And now we're trying to say people of color, and that came out of the civil rights movement and coalitions that formed in the 70s to have solidarity between groups of people who used to be called minorities, right? And now we're seeing that folks are talking about, let's talk about the long history of white supremacy and oppression and which groups in the country have been bearing the brunt of that for the past 500 years. And so I think language will continue to evolve. So I do think that one day this term will be obsolete, but I'm not sure if it's a fad or not. It's stuck around for the last year.
For the last year.
It has. It has. That's how long I've been using it.
So I was going to say, spoken like a young person. Oh my gosh, Theo, I want to ask you just about the sort of talking about evolution of terms used to describe Black Americans. When I was in journalism school, and I will not give the year because I don't want to date myself, but I had a professor who was Black, pioneering radio journalism at NPR. He hated the term African American because he said, how do you know someone's from Africa? How do you know where they're from? Unless you can tell me that you've asked them about their roots, you don't use that term. And he was the first person I'd heard say that. But in the years past, indeed, African American has become a less commonly used term. Talk to me about the evolution and really how you feel about these different terms.
Oh, wow. That's a really big question. African-American, I think, comes out of, again, this sort of effort to sort of think about ethnic groups and ethnic identity, right? So I think, it kind of starts in the 70s. You know, you think about like white ethnics sort of thinking themselves as Irish-American, Italian-American, using African-American as this parlance to think about specifically, people who are descended from slaves in the United States. Which, again, it sounds like a lovely politically correct term. Like we use, we continue thinking about Latin Americans and Asian Americans, et cetera, et cetera. But again, over time, we see a lot of people that come from this country that, who are not descended from slaves. And again, that label becomes very limiting in a lot of ways to describe those peoples who also experience some of the same kinds of structural oppressions that African Americans seem to do. So it becomes a very limiting kind of concept, in my opinion, as we begin to think about the evolution. I mean, I think there's a reason why Black was something that we use in the late 60s in order to describe, again, a kind of political movement that is kind of assets-based, that thinks about Black power, Black beauty, Black joy. And Black Lives Matter, I think, is picking up on that in really important ways that also recognizes, right, African-descended peoples who, again, may have very different histories, different trajectories, but again, also focusing on that sense of joy, challenging the political correctness, I think, that also sort of surrounded African-American in this kind of colorblind racism that picked up steam in the 90s and the early 2000s. And really is drawing attention, I think, to, again, how we think about people, again, African-descended peoples, and not just the ways of oppression, but also I think in the ways of power, the ways of agency, the ways of joy and happiness, that also sort of defines who we are. So I tend to find African-American as a kind of limiting term in a lot of ways. I usually call myself Black. I think it's soulful. It's fierce. It does the work that I needed to do. But again, I think there's a lot of other people that still use African-American and they can be used interchangeably. So
I think if that's somebody also says African-American, you're not offended.
No, not at all.
No, and I see you shaking your head too, Nicolette.
No, yeah. Both of us are just like, no.
No. Okay, good. Good. And Nicolette, I want to ask you about a term that Theo used, saying Black and brown people. I have to say something about that makes me uncomfortable. I can't put my finger on it. Why do you think that is? I guess it's just there's something I just don't like labeling period people period. Is that a problem, Nicolette?
I think for me, Dr. Green had mentioned the word colorblind racism, that, right. The notion and the tendency towards not wanting to name visible differences that we see even in skin color. Right. Oftentimes I find that to be limiting because I find my Blackness and my brownness to be something that I'm proud of and, is beautiful to me. And it has significance to me as an individual. So for me to be seen as a whole human being, I'm very proud of my Blackness. So
I guess the whole human being thing, I think, would apply to somebody who's blind or somebody in a wheelchair. This whole, like, if you put the adjective first and then person, isn't that defining that person by one part of who they are as a person?
And does any person live a single issue life? And that's not the case. I think, not to go too deep down the wormhole of theory, but intersectionality rescues us in that sense, because, a person is all of their lived social identities all at the same time. Like, my Blackness doesn't, foreground any other identity that I have as a person. I mean, if I speak about it, then, yeah, I see you, Theo.
Theo wants to jump in.
I was going to say intersectionality when used properly, right? Think about the fact that we are...
Not as an additive. So I think people use it as a, the oppression Olympics. So, okay, let's figure out how disadvantaged or how advantaged this person is. And that's not what the theory of intersectionality tells us. It tells us, we live at the intersections of so many different social identities, and that defines our worldview. And so me speaking about my Blackness doesn't mean that I'm not also a full human being. It doesn't take away from. So I guess, that's a very convoluted way of me saying that someone calling me Black or brown, for me as an individual, doesn't offend. I think about the census in the categories that we have to choose when that comes up. I have to choose African American or other. Like, what else would I choose in that regard? I know that that's becoming nuanced and that's updating, but the labels that we choose, especially when it comes down to race and ethnicity, defines our world in so many ways. So I think we'd be remiss to not acknowledge that.
I want to turn to the term Latinx. Professor Green, is this something you've studied? And tell me about that. There's been an evolution from when I was a child, the word Hispanic to Latino, and now Latinx. But Theo, just like we were talking about with BIPOC, I understand there are people who fit into this category who don't like the term.
And this one is fun, because I think only about 3% of people, young, and it's usually millennials that define themselves as Latinx. Everyone else, I think, hates or prefers Latino, Latina, Latine. And primarily because, it comes out of the late 90s. It comes out of a moment when, again, we're seeing the intersections of these identities with a broader understanding of gender and gender identity. Right. So the X is supposed to, I think, be a much more inclusive term, not only to think about, again, the binaries of male and female, but then also the gender nonconforming members of these communities as well. It picks up steam shortly after the Pulse, the shootings at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando in 2016, where, again, you're talking about LGBTQ Latinos and Hispanic and peoples and people and other peoples of color. And so that begins to pick up steam again in social media, begins to pick up steam in terms of how, the shootings, the tragedy was covered, et cetera. And again, I think what's happening is you now see a lot of studies that say, yes, millennials prefer that term because they find it to be much more considered of gender, those intersections of gender, racial and ethnic identity. But then you see a lot of people that find it, again, problematic. First of all, it's an awkward kind of thing to sort of say out of your mouth. It's not as beautiful as Latino or Latina, right? But at the same time, it's also... I think there's, gender is something that is also very complex within a lot of Latin American cultures. And so to sort of think about it in terms of Latinx, the way we think about it in the West ultimately takes away, again, those kinds of complex constructions of gender and gender identity that are in the countries of the many countries that make up Latin America. And so I think that's why we see a lot of those tensions happening there.
Nicolette, I see you nodding, but I can't go to you because I have to go to a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, please send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Lee Auto Malls, honoring Deborah Carver of Jonesport and all of the 2020 Maine County Teachers of the Year. Learn more at leeauto.com. And Maine Community Foundation, where donors with a passion for Maine plan their charitable giving for the future. Learn more at cf.org.
Climate change is causing heat waves, fires, floods, and extinctions.
How are you supposed to tackle these issues when you're in despair? Or you're panicked, take the energy of those emotions and redirect them into empowering action.
Airing this week, Climate Courage, how addressing the mental health impact of climate change can make us more effective at combating it.
That's coming up today at 2. on Maine Public Radio. Join us this evening at 8 on Maine Public Television as we dive into Pacific waters with nature and learn surprising facts about the sharks that call the warm waters near Hawaii's islands their home. We'll meet the white-tip reef shark, the whale shark, the tiger shark, and many more. Tune in for Sharks of Hawaii on Nature Tonight at 8 on Maine Public Television.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about why we use the labels we do to describe people, whether racial labels or other identities. Joining me, Theo Green, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Bowdoin College, and Nicolette Mitchell, who is director of equity and education at Bates College. Share your comments or questions via email to talk@mainepublic.org. Make it a brief email, please. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Marfine Chan. He is president of the Cambodian Community Association of Maine, and he is the Development, Communication, and Education Associate at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Thanks so much for calling in, Marfine.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We talked earlier about the term Black and brown people. You're Asian American. Do you feel that you are included in this category? I know some Asian Americans do and some do not, correct?
Correct. It's been a big discussion even in the last few months as Asian Americans in Maine have been coming together and have been galvanizing. It's sort of, the acronym BIPOC has been a big topic of discussion because it doesn't include Asian Americans or even brown people. And so I think this is just the issue that we have to deal with in American society in a country that, is rooted in colonialism and imperialism, capitalism. It's just, I think everything has sort of been boiled down to I think white supremacy, the goal is sort of a bland pudding, shall I say, of sameness and ignorance of difference and appreciation of difference, cultural differences, religions and races. And so I think this is the big discussion we need to have because, things have been reduced to binary, to black and white, to this or that. And so I think, it's important to have this discussion because we can't really live with sort of the convenient ways of the past.
Talk about a little bit about the evolution of the terms used to describe Asians. Why, for example, was the older term Oriental considered not appropriate? And why did Asian replace it in sort of maybe not my lifetime, but my parents' lifetime?
Yeah. The history with the term Oriental and the word yellow, for instance, were really terms used to other, people from of Asian descent, people from China, Korea, Japan, back in the 1800s when there were a lot of migrant workers and laborers coming from China and Japan specifically to work on building out the American railroads. Mm. Back after the Civil War, when there was a shortage of white workers, the railroad barons and the industrialists, needed cheap labor or labor. And so they had to turn to other countries to import laborers. And, the clash that occurred was between not only white workers and Chinese laborers and Japanese laborers, and then a little bit later on, Korean farmers and farm workers and Filipino farm workers. The clash that came, the terms Oriental and Yellow Peril and the Chinese Exclusion Act, all those sort of created this storm of anti-Asian sentiment in the country starting in the mid-1800s to present, actually. And so the term Asian American came about, I believe, shortly or during the Civil Rights Movement when Asian Americans were galvanized by the movement that was going on at the time with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And there was some need for solidarity between Chinese Americans, Filipino Americans, and Vietnamese Americans. And the way to do that was we need a terminology that can give us some sense of solidarity. But I'm sure your guests have also touched on this. What this ends up becoming for specifically white people who want to be woke and politically correct, or don't, or want to be seen as anti-racist, they sort of flatten those terms and overusing them, and really not doing the hard work of digging into the history of why does this exist, digging into the history of how are they complicit with white supremacy and racism, and I'll rest there.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned that this was a term of solidarity originally, but now that's problematic, isn't it? Because Asian American can mean so many different ethnicities, from Korean to Cambodian to Pakistani. Is it okay? I mean, we're talking billions of people in the world. Is it okay to call them all Asian?
Yeah, that's. I just had this conversation over the weekend and last week as we're organizing here in Maine. You know, should we use Pan Asian? Should we use Asian American and Desi Americans?
Wait, what did you just say? Desi Americans?
Desi Americans, yes. Which I cover. I think covers some of the subcontinent of Asia, in India and. That subcontinent region. And so a lot of this stuff is also new for me, but I think this is the struggle. This is, I think these conversations are on a continuum. It's not a one and done deal like so many other things when it comes to racial and social justice. You know, we ourselves have to do the work of looking into, you know, how do we be inclusive in our lexicon, in our terminology? How do we always sort of be aware that things may change a year or two down the road because of something we missed? And because there's a lot of digging up, a lot of uncovering that has to be done even amongst our own communities. And it's important that, you know, we don't settle for less, because especially in the Asian American population, or the acronym AAPI, the reason why we find that complicated or troublesome is that even the income disparities among Asian Americans is pretty great in terms of the top 10% earning over 10% more than the bottom 10% in terms of income. And that reflects how diverse the AAPI or Asian American community is. And so one of the best practices that I like to do is if I use an acronym or if I use a term like Asian American, I always follow up with trying to break down the different groups and the different disparities and inequities that are experienced by more discrete C-R-E-T-E, different groups.
Well, Marfine, thank you so much for calling in. Marfine Chan is with the Cambodian Community Association and the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Joining us now is Molly and Dana. She is the tribal ambassador for the Penobscot Nation. Thanks so much for calling in, Molly.
Thank you, Jennifer.
We have seen the term Native American go through many changes over the years, from Indian to American Indian, Native American, First People, Indigenous, Tribal. Tell us what is preferred today and why.
Great question. And I think if you ask 100 tribal citizens this question, you'll get 100 slightly different answers. So I'll do my best to give what I'm most comfortable with and what I feel like is the most respectful way to go about this. So I feel with tribal citizens, we first identify with our tribal nation. So I'll say, I'm Molly and Dana, I'm from the Penobscot Nation, and I feel that that's how a lot of tribal citizens speak. And then my next, you know, go to is probably talking about being part of the Wabanaki Confederacy and Alliance, because that talks about all of the tribal communities in our state. And then I like the term Indigenous. I feel like it's a real way to honor just how deep our roots are, and, you know, that stewardship of the lands and waters. And I feel that Indigenous is a real tribute to our ancestors. And with all that being said, I feel that the word Indian is something we haven't really been able to really move away from, because it's so woven into a lot of our, you know, practical reality. You know, all of the federal legislation regarding tribes is, you know, Indian Child Welfare Act, Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. We have the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. So, you know, that language is something we're having to use all the time. And a lot of tribal citizens have taken a lot of pride in reclaiming that word as part of their identity. And then when we get to Native American, I feel, you know, when somebody refers to us as Native American, I feel that they're most likely a person that is really trying to be respectful. And Native American has really been embraced as this, you know, really politically correct thing. And a lot of tribal citizens I speak to feel that that term doesn't quite represent them, because our tribal nations predate America. So it's certainly nuanced and complicated. And I think at the heart of all of this, you know, I know the program is about labels. And I feel that when we talk about labeling people, some people can find that burdensome or pejorative, you know, to have to address people how they want to be addressed. And they feel that's like this, you know, added struggle. But I would love to see people, you know, kind of turn that on its head and really see it as a way to truly honor the real identity of the people that they're interacting with. And if we can all kind of get on board with that, I feel that we're really moving in the right direction. And I can also appreciate where people really want to get it right, and that may hold them back from interacting altogether. So I want to put it out there that if you're really well-intentioned and coming from a good place, there's no harm in asking anybody how they would like to be identified and how to best refer to them and their community and their group. So
that's, I think that's wonderful advice. Yeah, to sure. Not be afraid to ask. Briefly, changing topics, Molly, and we did a show earlier this month on climate change and its effect on Indigenous communities. A caller called in asking about carbon credits and used your name, and I understand what he said about you was not accurate. So I want to give you a moment to correct that call.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I started to get, you know, texts and emails asking me why I'm in favor of carbon credits. So I was kind of confused about that question. But I certainly have never supported that personally or on behalf of the Penobscot Nation. And at the general meeting, when we were approached in our tribe about that a carbon credit proposal, I believe it was a unanimous vote to not accept it. And I was at that meeting and I did vote no. So I really appreciate the opportunity to kind of clear my name on that and just state that I don't support carbon credits on behalf of the Penobscot Nation. Thank you for that.
Well, Molly, and thanks so much for calling in. Molly and Dana, Tribal Ambassador for the Penobscot Nation. Nicolette, when you listen to what Molly and has to say about, you know, she said so much, but the just ask, what do you say to that when you're speaking with students at Bates College? What is your guidance to them, many of whom have come from communities that are not very diverse?
Absolutely. And you know, what Molly Ann said that really resonated with me is, you know, if you ask 100 people, you're likely to get 100 different answers, because, you know, what you're called oftentimes is so such a personal thing. I think a huge part of what needs to happen, and I think Molly Ann hit on this as well, is, you know, building those genuine relationships is so important and is key. And so, honoring who people are requires folks to also honor that identity. So yeah, just ask. And there's a respectful and good way to do that in a way that doesn't break down relationships. So what would you like to be called? very simple. He's like, how do you identify? I think is another phrase that students often use. And that is a way to enter into the conversation about, okay, how do we navigate this space? Some people might not want to be identified by their racial or ethnic community, and that's okay. But you wouldn't know if you didn't ask and open up that line of communication.
So all right, well, if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, our email address talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Jackson Laboratory, where researchers are on a mission to cure diseases like cancer, Alzheimer's, and diabetes. Learn more at jax.org. And Gather Restaurant in Yarmouth, partnering with Maine growers for a farm-fresh menu. Reservations or take-home menu at gathermaine.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. A jury in Minneapolis finds former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts of murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. Floyd, a black man, died when Chauvin, a white officer, pinned his knee on Floyd's neck for several minutes last May. We'll have the latest from Minnesota and reaction to the verdicts. That's next time on Here and Now.
And that's coming up in just a bit at 12 noon on Maine Public Radio. From bakeries to breweries, shoe shops to solar, a wide variety of businesses and organizations throughout Maine support this service. They understand the value of public radio and want to support it, and they want to reach you, the public radio audience. If your business or organization is interested in learning more, please visit mainepublic.org and click on support and connect your business with our audience, or call Dionysia Gaddis at 800-884-1717, and thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about the terms we use today to describe groups of people and what those labels say about our society. Our guests are Nicolette Mitchell with Bates College and Theo Green with Bowdoin College. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Be quick, please. You could call 1-800-399-3566, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Here we are in the last section of the program, Theo, and we really haven't talked about how we keep adding letters to what used to be LGBT and then LGBTQ. And what do you say today, and why do we keep adding letters? Or maybe I'll ask it the other way around. Why do we keep adding letters, and what do you use?
Well, you know, and LGBT came from LGB, that came from the use of the word gay, that had a large association with gay cis men. So, you know, LGBTQIA+, even though it is a mouthful, sometimes we call it an alphabet soup, I think also is what we commonly begin to use. We keep adding these these letters to this larger acronym, again, as a way to recognize the complexity of sexuality and gender expression, which this label sort of represents. We added the T in order to be able to be reflexive. We added the B to be thinking about bisexual people that began to mobilize as a political community in the late 80s and early 90s. We added the T to think about transgender and gender nonconforming people. And then again, as we began to sort of think even with greater complexity about these categories, we began to add even more. The A used to be allied before it became asexual. Because again, we see, right, the sort of visibility, the growing visibility, the growing mobilization around people who identify with those categories. So I think as we become much more nuanced in terms of how we think about gender and sexuality, more people become more visible. They want to gain recognition for who they are. We begin to continue to see more and more letters added to this. And so, you know, that plus sometimes gives me a tremendous amount of pause because, again, it erases a lot of categories. Some people prefer to use, try to combine all those and say queer to sort of think about living outside the binaries. But then that's also disrespectful to a lot of older gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people for whom that was a pejorative. So sometimes you just can't win in terms of these labels. But I think, again, that the notion of bringing them together to highlight the importance of non-normative gender and sexual identity has a very powerful political carriage to it. So,
okay. So if you're teaching a class and you're talking about these topics, is that what, and you have to say this over and over and over again, are you saying non-normative more often than you're saying the alphabet soup?
Well, you know, the classes I teach, I usually break them apart and we explore them.
Right.
Each. So, I usually do not, I do think of sex, sometimes I say sexual and gender minorities or gender sexual nonconforming or, you know, non-heterosexuals, sometimes to, you know, but whatever comes out of my mouth comes out of my mouth. That's just the way I approach my pedagogy, sadly. So sometimes it is LGBTQ plus, sometimes it is LGBTQIA, sometimes it's LGBT. Sometimes it's even LGB if we're thinking about groups that exclude transgender, gender nonconforming communities. So again, I think it's very context specific, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. And Nicolette, you find this a big part of the conversation on college campuses.
Absolutely. And folks have been talking about why we keep adding more letters to the end of the acronym LGBTQIA. So on campus, it's gotten to LGBTQIAP2+. Because we have folks who identify as pansexual, and we also have folks on campus who identify as two-spirit. And so the conversation on campus has been, you know, when we have an acronym and we leave off some of the additional identities, it's, you know, great for the folks who are included, but oftentimes it highlights the lack of sense of belonging for the folks who are not included in the acronym. And so how do we continue to make space and build community and honor the identities that are present in our space? That's been the conversation here at Bates. I'm sure that conversations look similarly or differently depending on what context. And I think Theo hit the nail right on the head. It's very context specific. Who are you talking about? What's the context? So.
An email, I'm going to combine two emails here because they're related. An email from Jim that says, please address the term white. Each time I check that box, I cringe. What can possibly replace it? And then Judith writes, I used to be called a WASP. Are there any current good terms for whites?
That is also a very good question. Again, because whites and who fit that category has shifted and changed over time, right? The early 20th century, you know, you could think about people from, you know, South, you know, people from Italy, people from other, you know, Eastern European that occupied a third race in between. And then again, the result of intermarriage over time, you know, we see a lot of people that once upon a time would have been thought of as a third race that become white. You know, I don't necessarily know if there is a good word for us to think about whites, think about white people or use that identity category. I think that a lot of people can, you know, there's a lot of people who still identify themselves with their ethnicity and sometimes deploy that some, you know, either symbolically or situationally. I'm Italian American, I am German American, you know. The challenge, I think, even becomes, right, throughout this, as a result of this intermarriage, right, there's so many white people that come from many different origins, right, which is why they sometimes have to deploy different kinds of identities at different times. And so, again, I think it you know, asking matters, but I think the whiteness also reflects the kinds of power structures, right, that exist within this country and around the world. And so, you know, it often is deployed as, I think, as a recognition of a certain kind of agency, certain kind of privilege that people often occupy, whether or not we want to get in that conversation.
Do you anything you'd like to add to that, Nicolette?
Yep, I'm thinking we've been wrestling with the term white on campus as well. You know, what does it mean? Well, what purpose does it serve? And it's replaced Caucasian, and that was rooted in some very messy pseudoscience, and is not actually rooted in, you know, either geography or, you know, actual biological science. And so moving more towards white, and I think Theo hit the nail on the head, it more now represents that longer term history of, you know, colonialism and imperialism. And finding a term that is better than white, I'm not sure that I have one that I can offer. And on campus, it's been for folks who would fall under that umbrella. It's for them to come together and decide as a community, okay, what does it mean to be white? What is whiteness? Is there a positive identity that's associated with whiteness? I think oftentimes on campus, when people have expressed wanting to move away from the term white, it's because it's been associated with this very deep and painful history of oppression and enslavement. And so what is a white identity apart from that? Those are questions that have been asked on campus. I can't, you know, as an individual answer that for folks, but I think it's something that folks have been reckoning with as individuals and coming to terms with that. So.
I have an email here from Patrick. Identification of groups, people, or individuals is simply a means of communication. However, it is often hijacked and corrupted to put people down, demean, and prop up to portray an air of superiority. Nicola, you agree, or at least you're nodding.
Was that the whole question?
That's it. It was a statement. Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if there was more. I think... I've been thinking about labels, and like oftentimes it can describe a community, and it can confer notions of superiority or inferiority depending on who's using it, but it can also be used to build up community and talk about, you know, the richness of a community. And I think also sometimes can flatten the differences and richness of experiences within the community. So a part of that really resonate with me in terms of it oftentimes for a community of people who fall under a label can be a positive thing. I think some of that joy that Theo talked about earlier can be reflected in a label, but sometimes it can be co-opted and turned into a way to be pejorative. And so it's that balance and that tension that we're talking about today, I think.
Yeah. Sure. Well, here's Marianne on Facebook. She writes, more terms to worry about offending, misuse, and what a minefield. My Irish-born father would not let us call ourselves Irish. You are American, he would say. If we call ourselves Americans, there would be more intersectionality. So it seems like Marianne is thinking that the way her father approached it was the right way. And is this what we're talking about when we're talking about flattening, Theo, the maybe thinking about this a little differently than prior immigrant groups, ethnic groups thought of themselves?
Well, absolutely. And again, you have to think about it in the context when Irish Americans were often feel as less valuable than Black people in the country, right? Because Black people were least property, right? You can take Irish Americans to some of the most dangerous jobs. And so there was such a that stigma, I think, made it possible to sort of, you know, for a lot of Irish Americans to sort of disavow that identity. But that again changes later on in the century as well, as more people begin to sort of think of their Irish American identity as a source of pride and as a source of joy. And so, you know, I think the challenge with thinking of us all as Americans is that in order for us to do that, we really have to think about how complex Americans really are. And we are not there yet. I mean, if we continue, the fact that we continue to have these stories about various groups and their interactions with the institutions and structures, it is very clear, right? There is people at the top and people at the bottom. And we have to be able to reckon with that first before we can really begin to sort of think about who is an American and how complex that American identity is.
We'll go to Terry. Terry's calling from Sorrento. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
I call very reluctantly because every time I've mentioned the issue I'm about to talk about among my family, I get heaps of abuse dumped on me. But my basic point is the very terms we use to distinguish people of different races, in this particular case, Black and white, are based on a lie. Anybody who looks at their hand who is described as white sees their hand is not white. It is an off-color kind of pinkish reddish color. A person described as a Black person, if you look at a color wheel, is not Black. These very terms we use are based on a deep racist necessity to distinguish Black from white, but the terms we use are simply a lie.
Terry, I appreciate you calling in. Theo, Nicolette, who wants to go first?
I think, you know, lie can be replaced with social construction. I think that the reality is people create these labels and then we believe them to be true. And I think that is the, and so I think, you know, saying it's a lie can be very complex because I think we have over time began to accept those as truths. But they are social constructions. They are not natural. And I think it goes back to something, Jennifer, that you said earlier about using brown with this discomfort, right? Black and brown and white are rooted in this scientific racism. And yet we haven't been able to let those go. We continue to sort of value them. Sometimes we reclaim them as a source of power. But they are, I think, again, they're not precise. They do not describe us, you know, who we are. They don't describe our full humanity. And so, you know, I think, you know, you know, Terry, I think the important thing is I wouldn't say lie. I think lie presumes judgment. I would just say it is a social construction. It is something that we've created and we force ourselves to drink that Kool-Aid.
Nicolette, anything you'd like to add to that?
Hit the nail on the head in terms of talking about a social construct that has now been adopted. I think it's also now enshrined in our policies, in our practices, in the way that we think about how we relate to one another. And so, yes, it's definitely not rooted in biology by any means. It definitely was used, especially what the caller had said, you know, the binary of black and white to rank humanity, you know, humanity and humanness and who gets to have resources and who does the labor. And also we have not yet reckoned with that history, which is why these labels persist. Until we reckon with that history, we can't just say we're all American and we're all equal. We're not, I agree with Theo, we're not quite yet there. And so what utility do we have? You know, how can we talk about these divisions that do exist?
All right, Terry, thank you so much for calling. I just want to ask, for many people, especially people who are older, who use terms that are now considered unacceptable, is it okay to slip up? I mean, if people are people of goodwill and are trying their best, Theo, what do you say?
And I confront this a lot with, I think, a lot of our students who are dealing with pronoun usage, for example. I think only if you're willing to sort of accept it and learn from it. I think, you know, we all make mistakes. We're all human beings. But if we have to recognize that the language evolves and changes, and if we continue to be entrenched or dig deeper into, you know, something that has changed and shifted and has become obsolete, I think that becomes the problem. And that's what makes us reticent to have, again, these real conversations about these issues that continue to divide us. So, I say, yes, you can be well-intentioned. I think acknowledging it is important and learning from that experience so that you can try not to make that mistake again. And I think we have to be more open and accepting to people making those mistakes as well, because I think that also helps generate the necessary conversations we need to have.
All right. Well, that's going to be the last word because we're out of time. I can't believe a whole hour has gone by. Thank you so much for joining us. Theo Green is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Bowdoin College, and Nicolette Mitchell is Director of Equity in Education at Bates College. Today's sound engineer was Stella Mars. Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling, and today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Tomorrow on the program, we talk with independent bookstore owners to learn how their businesses are faring, and we will get some good book recommendations, especially those for Earth Day. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.